much.
He says here the Houthis too will learn what Hamas and Hezbollah and the Assad regime and others have learned. He listed off the recent military actions, he says, that have brought down these Iranian backed groups. He says that the Houthis will also be taken down. And, quote, even if it takes time, he says, this lesson will be understood across the Middle East. And that's concerning many of an escalation of hostilities here in the region.
Well, as Netanyahu alluded to, Israel has been weakening its enemies on multiple fronts, including Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza, both also supported by Iran. What are you hearing about the Houthis' capabilities, Carrie?
Interestingly, I was listening to a former intelligence officer, and he was saying that Israel's behind in its intelligence on the Houthis in Yemen. Yemen just wasn't their main focus for the last 20 years. Iran and Hezbollah were, and Yemen and the Houthis are a different enemy for Israel. Yemen is far away, and it will require the assistance of other militaries, primarily the U.S., to fight the Houthis. The U.S. does have a major battle group in the Red Sea at this time, actually, and Israel is fighting wars on multiple fronts now. It's in Gaza, it's in Lebanon, it's in Syria, continuing raids in the occupied territories. It is stretched.
That's NPR international correspondent Carrie Kahn. Thanks, Carrie.
You're welcome.
Officials in Azerbaijan say they have opened an investigation into Wednesday's crash of an airliner in Kazakhstan. Russia's state aviation authority said the plane had left Azerbaijan's capital, and they say in mid-flight, the plane hit a flock of birds and tried to make an emergency landing in Kazakhstan, hundreds of miles away from its destination in Russia's Chechnya region. The crash killed dozens of passengers, although at least 29 survived. Captain John Cox is a retired airline pilot. He now leads an aviation consulting firm and joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So Russia, Kazakhstan, and Azerbaijan all say they are investigating this crash. Just to sort of set the table here, what happens first at the site of a crash like this?
The first thing is the organization as to who's going to lead the investigation, and that they're going to conduct the investigation in accordance with the worldwide standards through the International Civil Aviation Organization. The experts then show up. They're divided into groups, and then the groups that will be in the field will go look at the wreckage. Others will look at operations, the maintenance on the aircraft. So there's a number of groups with specialists on each of these groups that actually conduct the legwork of the investigation.
Now, crashes involving multiple governments are already complex. This plane crashed in Kazakhstan near the border with Russia, which is on high alert because of Moscow's war against Ukraine. Now, we should say this was not near Ukraine, but how does an investigation proceed differently, perhaps, in wartime?
Certainly, you don't want the investigators themselves to be put at risk. That's the first thing. And then secondly, when you have a wreckage, as we do in this case, that has indications that it was near an explosion and there are appearances of puncture wounds in the fuselage and tail, similar to what we saw with Malaysia Flight 17 that was shot down by the Russians, those things make the investigators begin to look in greater depth for the possibility that this was actually shot down.
Of course, there have been those reports. NPR cannot independently confirm those reports. But what do you make of those pockmarks you mentioned, reminiscent of an explosion that might have occurred outside the aircraft rather than inside? What does that say to you?
It says the aircraft was highly likely in the close proximity of an explosion, and that explosion included shrapnel. There's a mounting body of evidence to support that. The fact that the oxygen masks inside the aircraft were deployed, that says that the airplane was depressurized at some point. The flight path was a bit erratic, which says that the crew was fighting for control of the airplane and had limited control, which would be similar to what we saw with the United Airlines flight many years ago in Sioux City, Iowa. And then the actual pictures of the puncture wounds, which are similar to Malaysia Flight 17, all of those point to the possibility that there was an explosion, potentially of an anti-aircraft missile, near the aircraft.
Now, as we said earlier, Russia blames a bird strike, a flock of birds. Do you see any evidence that that could be possible.
The evidence so far is inconsistent with a bird strike. One, you don't hear the crew say that. Two, a bird strike doesn't cause the kind of damage that we're seeing on this aircraft. Fortunately, both of the recorders, the cockpit voice recorder and the digital flight data recorder, have been recovered. And so we'll get a look at to actually what happened in pretty short order, probably a week or so, we'll know. But this is not consistent with a bird strike.
We'll have a better sense within a week of what might have triggered this. I mean, when do you think there, in terms of the bigger picture, how this all played out, when do you think there will be a definitive answer?
It'll take a year to 18 months to get a final report, and I'm hopeful they can do it that quickly. I think, though, because there's so much interest in this, that there will be, once the cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder are read, I think we'll have a better idea of what happened. And I think that information will probably be made public.
That's aviation consultant John Cox. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
My pleasure.
There are just a few days left to come up with resolutions for the new year. Like, what do you want to do better for yourself or maybe for others? How about resolving to avoid reaching for your phone first thing in the morning?
It's so much easier said than done.
Don't I know it. Brad Zickerman is a psychiatrist at Stanford who treats children and adolescents.
I honestly find that working with teens with problematic screen use can be more challenging than working at times with teens who have severe opioid use disorders.
Now, the American Psychiatric Association acknowledges that smartphones are the constant companions for many people. The group considers compulsive or out-of-control use of technology an area of concern. Zickerman says he also worries about screen dependency.
If you are using it to the point where you have to wake up and the first thing habitually that you find yourself doing is reflexively going to your phone, to me, that is a sign that you have actually developed a potential addiction to your phone.
The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends making a family media plan that concentrates on the quality of screen time. And Zickerman says, start with getting your phone away from your bed.
If your phone is not in your room, you're going to sleep better. And then also when you wake up in the morning, it's not going to be right next to you. And you're not going to have that temptation to actually reach for your phone first thing in the morning.
He says trying to break the habit first thing in the morning is akin to a strategy psychiatrists use to help smokers quit.
Figuring out ways to delay that first cigarette. I think screen use is similar in that if you are able to figure out ways to delay the time that you first check your phone in the morning, I think ultimately you're probably going to end up checking it less throughout the day, actually.
Okay, it sounds challenging, but I'm up for it. And I'm going to tell my editors that if they can't reach me when there's breaking news, it's because I'm trying to break this phone addiction. This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:19. It's a Friday, the final Friday of the year. Can you believe that? I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but this year seems like it has been flying by. I guess that's what happens, though, when you have a new baby in the year. You kind of start to just everything else becomes a blur. We have Wisconsin Life coming up later this hour on the program. Today, Corrine Hess will take us on a trip to Milwaukee for the annual Tattoo Arts Festival. That's coming up in 25 minutes on WPR.
When you give to Wisconsin Public Radio, you have a powerful impact. You make WPR a place that hundreds of thousands of people turn to for independent news, national conversations, and Wisconsin stories, as well as laughter just when it's needed. WPR is listener-supported, and that means you make a difference. Make your year-end gift right now at WPR.org/donate. Thank you.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
WGTD.org is your portal to public radio, beginning with local news, station information, program schedules, old programs, and videos. WGTD.org includes links to NPR, Wisconsin Public Radio, and WGTD's Facebook page.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather, a winter weather advisory is in effect for about the next 45 minutes in northeastern Wisconsin. It expires at 9. The rest of the state is under a dense fog advisory until noon today. High temperatures in the 30s and 40s today, and it's not going to get much colder overnight. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Craft in America, with two new episodes on craft and the handmade, science, and collectors. Now streaming on the PBS app and craftinamerica.org, premiering on PBS and YouTube Friday, December 27th. From EBSCO, committed to upholding the principles of responsible research as they work to develop AI technologies to enhance research around the world. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon. Every December, NPR critic Linda Holmes looks back on the year in pop culture and makes a list of 50 wonderful things. Among them, the game Astrobot, sports from Linda's favorite team to the Olympic Games, not to mention the cast of Cardinals in the movie Conclave. They're all on Linda's list for 2024. Linda Holmes is a host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, and she's here with me now to share some of the things that brought her joy this year. Hey, Linda.
Hi, Sarah.
So you have one of the coolest jobs. You watch a lot of TV and movies for work. Several standout performances made your list this year. Just tell us about some of those.
Absolutely. First, I would talk about Colman Domingo. If there is anything Colman Domingo cannot do, I have not found it. This year, he was wrapped up in a conspiracy in the Netflix thriller series, The Madness, that gave him some action sequence opportunities. But most importantly, he does great and empathetic, dramatic work in the drama Sing Sing. It's based on the real story of the drama program for incarcerated people at Sing Sing Prison. Here's his character during a clemency hearing in the film.
It's been a program that was established to help the population with management skills. And it's turned into something a bit more, wonderful, because it helps people get more in touch with their feelings and able to process and actually move through and truly get some rehabilitation.
So are you acting at all during this interview?
The movie is so good. It is also a great story about filmmaking, because a bunch of the supporting actors are men who were there and went through this theater program while they were incarcerated, who are sort of playing versions of themselves. Some of them helped develop the script as well. So it's a story where they gave the real people some ownership and some involvement that absolutely shows in the final product. The other one I would mention is a great year of work from an actor named Tim Bagley, who's been doing TV and movies since the early 1990s. He brought so much grace to this role of Brad on the HBO show Somebody Somewhere. If you haven't seen Somebody Somewhere, please check it out. He also had a great, great scene on the series Hacks. And he's just one of those guys who has been around forever, radiates kindness in this beautiful way. And it's great to see him get two great showcases in the same year.
You've got a couple of remakes on your list. Those seem to be really popular right now for some reason. Sometimes I think some people love them, some people hate them. But nonetheless, I want to talk about one title that was on your list of best TV this year, and that's Mr. and Mrs. Smith. People may remember the film almost 20 years ago. What did you like about the TV remake?
Yeah, I thought it was really stylish and fun. It stars Donald Glover and Maya Erskine as strangers who are recruited to play a married couple and operate as spies. It's really great to look at. It's also really just charming and funny. Here they are unpacking what they're going to need for their first assignment.
These look like they're ours. State license, banking card, carry permit, and marriage certificate.
Yeah, that goes to some really fun places. That show is sexy and romantic. It also has lots of action. The show is just a ton of fun. Again, Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Okay, I want to talk about a comedy. You've got a couple stand-up specials here. Can you tell us about Rachel Bloom's?
Yeah, Rachel Bloom's Death Let Me Do My Special on Netflix is a mostly one-woman show. It's part comedy, part storytelling, part music, in which she talks about this very terrible moment she had early in the onset of COVID. Within a period of days, her daughter was born and sent to the NICU, and her creative collaborator, the very brilliant songwriter Adam Schlesinger, died of COVID. And she's always been, you know, she made the show My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. She's always been great at balancing really bawdy, dirty, silly humor with really devastating emotional moments, and that's exactly what this special is.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I like to turn to comedy when I just want to laugh and kind of turn off my brain. This might not be the right one for that, but it sounds like it's still funny.
It is really funny, and it ends on a note of, like, I don't know if I would call it hope, but it ends on a note of deep, deep humanity and compassion kind of toward herself and other people. Again, it's called Death Let Me Do My Special.
Okay, books. I love nonfiction, but I have a resolution to read more fun books next year. Can you give us one to start with?
Yeah. One of the books on the list this year is Holly Gramazio's The Husbands, in which a woman who's never been married discovers that her attic is producing husbands who seem to think they've always been her husband. Whenever one goes back up into the attic, a new one comes down and she starts over. There are obviously some entertaining logistics to this. How do you keep a husband you like from going up to the attic and vanishing and being replaced by another one? How do you get one that you don't particularly like to go up there and get disappeared so that you can get a fresh one? But the premise is so funny that the whole time I kept thinking, I don't know how this author is going to land this ending. And then the ending is really clever and poignant. It fits the book. I really, really, really liked this book. Again, it's called The Husbands.
Your beloved Philadelphia Phillies are on your list too.
Mm-hmm.
What was your favorite moment?
I got to cram my team in here every year. One of my favorite Phillies moments came when outfielder Brandon Marsh lost a ball in the sun, stuck out his glove, and caught it anyway. And here is the NBC Sports coverage of that moment, which was back in August.
Fly ball, center field, well hit. Marsh going back out toward the wall, and he can't see it. Oh, he made the catch. He couldn't see it the entire time. He stuck his glove out, and it landed there. That is unbelievable. He went to the right neighborhood.
Yes, baseball is magic. Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, you know.
For sure. That's Linda Holmes, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Thanks, Linda.
Thank you, Sarah.
Linda Holmes writes the Pop Culture Happy Hour newsletter each week. You can subscribe by going to npr.org/newsletters and scrolling down to Pop Culture Happy Hour. This is NPR News.
The world is about to mark the 25th anniversary of the ultimate cliffhanger, Y2K, the computer bug that was either going to be easy to fix or the end of the world.
It's important to draw the line between what the popular imagination was prepared for and what the experts were actually saying.
I'm Juana Summers. We look back at the Y2K bug on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 3 until 6:30, today on WPR.
This is WPR News.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us at 8:29. Another case of bird flu has been identified on a Wisconsin poultry farm. That story just ahead in news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Azerbaijan Airlines says its preliminary investigation finds Wednesday's plane crash was caused by what it described as physical and technical interference from outside the plane. It was on a flight from Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, to the Russian city of Grozny when it crashed while attempting to land in Kyrgyzstan. At least 38 people were killed. A U.S.-funded group that tracks food security around the world has taken down its latest report on Gaza. The report said that a famine was unfolding there, but NPR's Michelle Kelman reports U.S. officials raise doubts about that information.
The Famine Early Warning Systems Network says its latest alert on Gaza is under review and will be re-released with updated data and analysis in January. The alert had warned of an impending famine in North Gaza, but U.S. officials say the group had inflated the number of people living in the area. The U.S. ambassador to Israel, Jack Lew, called it irresponsible. The U.S. Agency for International Development, which created the Famine Monitoring Group, says it requested the report to be updated. A spokesman says the U.S. is still deeply concerned about the scale of food insecurity in Gaza and the, quote, minimal amount of assistance that has reached Palestinians in the north. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. Another Wisconsin poultry operation has been hit by bird flu. This time, it's a commercial poultry farm in Burnett County. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that 23,000 turkeys, which were on the land, have been destroyed to prevent the spread of the disease. 9 people who worked on the farm, all of them are being monitored for symptoms. So far, none of them have shown any symptoms yet. Bird flu has been found in several Wisconsin counties. That includes Barron County, where the state's first confirmed case of bird flu in a human was detected earlier this year. So far, there's been no evidence of person-to-person transmission of the disease. A central Wisconsin shoemaking company is expanding its operations. Weinbrenner Shoe Company says a new $15 million factory will open next year. The company produces Thoroughgood work boots. Founded in 1892, the Merrill-based company is one of the oldest shoe manufacturers in the United States. Andrew Helverson is with the Ellis Construction Company, which designed and is building the facility. He says the new site also allows Weinbrenner to grow in the future.
We were able to plan for added expansion and the ability to nearly double the size of the facility on the site.
Weinbrenner will also add 35 new jobs to its 150 workers in Marshfield. The company has a union workforce and is employee-owned. The city of Milwaukee will use $15 million in federal grants to place over 50 electric vehicle charging stations across the city. The grants are from the U.S. Department of Transportation's Charging and Fueling Infrastructure Program. It will be used to build 53 charging stations. Each station will have 4 ports for electric vehicles. City officials will soon decide where to place them. However, priority is going to be given to public libraries. A private company will build and operate those stations. City leaders hope that construction will start sometime in 2026. In weather, a dense fog advisory is in effect for the majority of Wisconsin until about noon today. We could see some rain later on, especially in the south, with high temperatures in the 30s and 40s. And it's going to stay pretty warm overnight as well. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Churchill Downs, presenting the 151st Kentucky Derby, dedicated to creating unforgettable memories for more than 150 years. The Kentucky Derby on Saturday, May 3rd. Learn more at KentuckyDerby.com. And from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at WallaceFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon. Georgia straddles Europe and Asia, and it has an important and complicated relationship with neighboring Russia.
This weekend, the country is set to swear in a new president, and he is a vocal critic of the West. This follows protests that broke out in the capital, Tbilisi, last month after the government decided to suspend talks to join the European Union. Meanwhile, Georgia's incumbent president has refused to stand down following October's disputed election. Joining me now is reporter Robin Forestier-Walker, who's been following the protests. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So who is the newly elected president, and why is this looking like a potential showdown between Georgia's opposition and the government?
So Mikhail Kavilashvili is 53 years old. He's a former soccer player turned politician for the Georgian Dream Party. That's the governing party. And he's played an important role in the government's shift away from the West. He's set to be inaugurated on Sunday. But the demonstrators who've been protesting after the government's U-turn on the EU really dislike Kavilashvili. He's known for criticizing the West, in particular US support for Georgian democracy. The incumbent president, Salome Zurabishvili, refuses to step down. She's positioned herself as the last defender of Georgian democracy because she believes the government is taking Georgia off its constitutionally mandated pro-European path. So tensions are rising with two presidents claiming legitimacy, and with the prime minister threatening to arrest Zurabishvili, there's a real risk of confrontation.
How did Georgia get to where it is now, and what is Russia's role here?
Well, there was this simmering anger over parliamentary elections in October. Observers questioned their fairness, but the nationwide protests really ignited when the government announced it was suspending talks on EU membership at the end of November. Polls consistently show strong public support for Georgia joining the EU, and the demonstrators want new elections. And over the last month, they've become more organized, and overall, they've been largely peaceful, but police have arrested more than 500 people, and there's been clear evidence of police brutality, which has led the US and some European states to sanction senior officials. President Zurabishvili has openly accused the Kremlin of undermining Georgian sovereignty. She points to Russia's opposition to Georgia's EU and NATO aspirations. The Kremlin has openly praised the Georgian government for introducing controversial legislation that curtails civil liberties. And crucially, the governing party, Georgian Dream, is led by a billionaire who made his fortune in Russia. Critics say that means President Vladimir Putin has significant leverage over him.
Now, the Georgian Dream Party, this is Georgia's governing party, they say they're pro-European still, though, right? I mean, what happens next here?
So the government claims it's going to revisit the question of European membership in 2028. And meanwhile, officials are hoping for a reset in relations with the US under the Trump administration. They say they share his values, but we don't know Trump's stance on Georgia yet. Last month in Paris, President Zurabishvili made a point of introducing herself to Trump, highlighting Georgia's role in the broader Russian conflict and Georgia's European aspirations. And many Georgians take heart that a number of Republicans are strong advocates for Georgian democracy. Some of them have warned that a Trump administration could respond harshly to any potential crackdown after December 29th.
That's reporter Robin Forestier-Walker, who's been following the protests in Tbilisi, Georgia. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Peace activists in Israel are lonely voices these days. After more than a year of war in Gaza following the October 7th Hamas attacks, it's hard for their talk of reconciliation with the Palestinians to be heard. Many are worried that the incoming Trump administration may not want to hear it. NPR's Michelle Kellerman talked to activists who are trying to keep that hope alive.
Mao Zinon made his name in the tourism business in Israel, running a hostel in Nazareth. But these days, he says he's changed careers.
I'm now a full-time peacemaker.
He took on the role after the devastating death of both of his parents on October 7th of last year. They were killed in their home when Hamas militants stormed over the border from Gaza. His mother was an artist who, he says, encouraged him to chase his dreams.
And I have a dream. I dream of peace from the river to the sea. And my mom gave me the ability to dream and the courage to chase and fulfill my dream. So this is exactly what I'm doing now.
His father was a farmer who always liked to say that after a bad harvest, you should plant again and hope for something better. Inon says his father's words resonate more than ever.
And now I realized it's up to me. It was the worst year, devastating year ever in the 100 years of conflict between Israel and Palestine. But next year will be better, and it's my turn to make it better.
We meet in the courtyard of Open House, a peace education center in Ramleh, a mixed Jewish and Palestinian city in central Israel. Inan is holding an event here featuring Palestinian and Israeli rappers. There are women in hijabs, others in t-shirts covered in peace slogans. Inan has been taking part in events like this all over Israel to try to change the discourse about the war in Gaza.
So my name is Samih Nasser Abdullah bin Muhammad bin Rabi' Zakut, aka Saz. I'm an actor, singer, was born and raised in Ramleh. It's a city between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
Sameh Zakut is a Palestinian citizen of Israel who says he lost at least 40 relatives in the war in Gaza. He's posted videos about them living in flimsy tents without food, but he says he's getting a lot of hateful messages on social media.
And they're just telling me, We pray that your family will be vanished and killed. It's just a shame. I'm going to do a new video this week about this hate messages. And I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to use their hate to make hope. That's what I'm doing.
He says he's worried that some people close to Donald Trump have said that Palestinians don't exist or that Palestinian statehood is a fantasy. But he's trying to stay positive and promote the more moderate voices.
You cannot fight the darkness. You only have to enlighten the light. That's what you're going to do. I cannot fight the darkness around the world. It's not just Palestine and Israel. I think it's all around the world.
His Israeli friend Maoz Inan echoes that.
At the moment, the world is facing a leadership meltdown. We don't see any leaders. We see only politicians.
Politicians here and around the world who play on people's fears. Inan says he was disappointed in the Biden administration and the first Trump administration, which prioritized Arab-Israeli normalization deals over a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
And this is part of the reason why we faced October 7th. But what I learned is that we must forgive for the past. We must forgive for the present, but we cannot and we will not forgive about the future.
He's not offering any prescriptions, one state or two, but says there will be no security and safety for Israelis unless Palestinians have that too. And he and the activists here will continue to send that message to the incoming Trump administration. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Ramleh, Israel.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:42. It is a Friday. Really appreciate you spending part of your Friday with us. I know I keep saying it, but it's the final Friday in 2024. I really can't believe it's come this far. Still to come this hour on the program, we've got Wisconsin Life just a few minutes from now. WPR's Corinne Hess is going to take us on a trip to Milwaukee for the annual Tattoo Arts Festival. That's ahead, plus news at 9 o'clock on WPR.
Need a hand with that? Maybe Larry can help.
Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at training your pet.
And see if you can manage your debt on your own.
There is an iPhone storage setting that you can go into. It will tell you how much storage each application on your phone is using.
And I found that incredibly helpful.
Great questions.
You can be a lot of things.
The Larry Mueller Show, weekday mornings at 11 on WPR News.
Support for WPR comes from Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona. With Across a Wide Ocean, remarkable stories about the origins of identity. On view now through January 5th. More at mmam.org.
Support for WGTD comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center, promoting quality of life by offering information, support, and options. Our services are free and confidential. For more information, call 262-605-6646.
Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio at 8:44. Here's what's happening in news. Aviation experts say that Russian air defense fire was likely responsible for the Azerbaijani plane crash, which killed 38 people and left 29 survivors injured yesterday. As the official investigation gets underway, some experts have pointed out that holes were seen in the plane's tail section. Houthi rebels in Yemen fired a missile at Israel early today. hours after a wave of Israeli airstrikes hit Yemen's main airport as the World Health Organization's director general was about to board a flight there. And in Wisconsin, nearly 200 ballots cast in last month's presidential election in Madison were not counted, but the city clerk says that they were not enough to affect the outcome of any race on the ballot. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals with a track record of excellence. More information on this year's MacArthur Fellows is at macfound.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with a trip to a tattoo convention in Milwaukee.
Milwaukee lives up to its nickname as the City of Festivals, as it draws millions of visitors every year. But it's the annual Milwaukee Tattoo Arts Festival that draws more than 200 artists from around the world for 3 days of inking and intrigue. WPR's Corrine Hess takes us on a tour of the festival to meet the tattoo artists and their human canvases.
The sounds of buzzing fills the air as you walk into the Milwaukee Tattoo Festival. Booths showcase unique styles of each artist. Some customers browse, others know exactly what they want. They've traveled hundreds of miles to get inked by their favorite artists.
So funny story, I was in the military for years, went into Playboy, did a lot of TV and film, and I just woke up one morning and my husband's like, what are you doing today? And I was like, I'm gonna sell the company and become a tattoo artist. And he was like, okay, let's do it.
That's Michelle Manhart. She gained fame in 2007 when she posed for Playboy, appearing in and out of her U.S. Air Force uniform and also draped with the American flag. Michelle was reprimanded and demoted for the appearance and later quit the military. Now a full-time tattoo artist in southern Georgia, the Milwaukee Festival is one of her annual stops.
So Milwaukee Convention is one of our top favorites. We do it every year unless for some reason, you know, a natural disaster. Even that didn't stop us. We're still like, let's go. The Milwaukee people, don't get me wrong, like I've seen some mean people in Wisconsin, right? The northern attitude. But inside here, I kept in touch with people over the years that I've met. I think it's because we have a common, you know, they don't just come here thinking, oh, what's going on? They come with a purpose. They know, you know, and they're just always so nice. They have so many great ideas. They're very artistic, but they let us have the freedom.
Freedom to tattoo customers with Michelle's signature style of cartoons, portraits, and flowers. A couple of booths over is another artist who made the journey to Milwaukee for the convention.
How you doing? My name is Daryl Cleveland. Everybody call me DJ. I own Moving Murals Art Studio out of Philadelphia. Just here to tattoo, leave my mark on the city. I always knew how to draw, and I went to get a tattoo one day, and the guy didn't know how to draw. And he was like, well, I can't do it until you have a picture. So I sat there and drew the picture, and he tattooed it. And I was like, well, I could have did this. So the next day, I got a machine and been tattooing ever since.
DJ's tattoos are beautiful, detailed line work. He offers clients anything from images to Medusa, to the Joker, to intricate faces of their own children.
Tattooing is fun, but it's like the creation process that's really the fun, you know? Like, just building it, and then, yeah, like building the tattoo, like, because it starts with just one line, you know? And then by the time it's done, you got magic.
A young Milwaukee woman is getting work done in another booth. It's of one of her favorite Disney characters.
Kara, Kim Pagnus.
I'm Matt Sorensen.
I met Matt like 10 years ago. My parents live in Davenport. I got tattoos with my dad and my brother from him, and I've been getting tattooed from him ever since. I've always loved The Little Mermaid ever since I was a child, so I actually told Matt about that idea years ago, and he came up with the whole concept, and it's finally coming together.
Swinging back around to Michelle, a large photo of her naked body from her Playboy days is attracting visitors.
So how many tattoos do you have?
I kind of have this personal joke that if you know how many you have, you don't have enough. Because if you can count them, you just don't have enough. They're not flowing together anymore. So I don't know. Like, my entire back is done. I have full sleeves. I have a lot of leg tattoos. But still plenty of room for a lot more. So I really don't know how many. I can show you my favorite one. This is my favorite tattoo. My grandson actually did it on me.
It's a scribble on Michelle's arm.
He has been somewhat in the shop since he was born. And when he was 3 years old, he did his own stencil. He did his own setup, everything all the way through from beginning to end. We just guided him in places where he may have needed things. And he was only three.
WPR's Tattoo List reporter Corrine Hess brought us those voices from the Milwaukee Tattoo Arts Festival. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And I'm Alex Crow, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Gregory Berg. The studios of WGTD will be closed from December 28th through January 1st for the holidays, and during that time there will be no morning show broadcast. But each and every day there will be a different morning show podcast episode for you to enjoy, with interviews drawn from the morning show archives. The podcast version of the morning show is available wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, but be sure to look for the right name, The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. A winter weather advisory is in effect for the northeastern part of the state. It's set to expire in about the next 9 minutes, though. However, a dense fog advisory is in effect for the rest of Wisconsin, and that's going to be lasting until noon today. We could see some rain later on, especially in the south today, with high temperatures in the 30s and 40s. Overnight, it's not going to get much colder. In fact, it'll stay the same, with lows in the 30s and 40s. This is WPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon. Holiday rom-coms have become a staple for many families this time of year. They tend to be safe to watch with multiple generations in the room. They're also a big business for cable and streaming services. The Hallmark Channel has turned Christmas movies into a mega industry, adding 32 new holiday features this year, including one for Hanukkah.
So we need someone to cover Cabo Kara's shift. Got any plans tonight?
You can't just hire some random person off the street.
Hey, go back to Florida.
Yeah, the chutzpah on this guy.
That's how you say it.
Thank you.
Julie Sherman-Wolf has written about 24 Hallmark movies. Her latest features are Hanukkah on the Rocks and Holiday Touchdown, which had a Thanksgiving week debut that Nielsen ranked as the year's most watched cable movie.
If I only had to write Christmas movies, I would. I love doing them. And Hanukkah, by the way. I've just always been a huge fan of the comfort and warmth that you get during the Christmas season, especially when you're watching all these movies with your family. So I'm just happy to sort of contribute to that genre a little bit in my way.
I think people love the fact that Hallmark movies, especially Christmas movies, they are kind of warm and cozy and fun and light. They're also, you know, arguably predictable in a certain way. I think you kind of know what you're signing up for when you watch one of these films. But how do you lend your own creativity to this process? And how do you think about building new storylines?
So our job is to, you know, tell a Christmas story. And of course, we know how it's going to end because that's why people come to Hallmark to watch these movies and have a happy ending. I try my best to keep people guessing throughout the entire movie of not, you know, not that they're going to get together, but how can I surprise anybody at the end of how it's going to end instead of it being predictable? I mean, there's literal bingo games of people where they check off boxes of stuff that, you know, they think is going to happen. You know, there's hot chocolate whipped cream on the nose, and there's a falling down ice skating. those kind of tropes, which I've tried to flip those sometimes in the Holiday Touchdown movie.
Okay, here's what we gotta do.
The mom and the grandma basically try to get Hunter King's character to put something on her face so that Tyler Hines' character can gently wipe it away in a romantic comedy moment.
It's in all the Christmas movies. It never fails. Love it.
You know, as a Kansas City native, I have to ask you about Holiday Touchdown, the new one out this year. How did you come up with this one?
Well, you know, I'm actually a huge 49er fan. So the great irony of doing this movie was that they called me probably 3 days after the Super Bowl and said, okay, I need you to, you know, take off your Niner hat for a second and put your Rider hat back on. The good news is I had an idea already kind of noodling around in my head because we are such a huge sports family and we have so many silly superstitions that around the 49ers, and you know, the certain jacket has to be buttoned a certain way, and this hat has to be worn if it's this game, and all these things. That's kind of where that story took off from.
You mentioned the Chiefs. How much was this movie inspired by the relationship between Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce, who, of course, is a tight end for the Chiefs?
Well, I would say that the movie itself, the story and the plot, is not inspired by that relationship. But what was inspired by them was just when this romance was blooming last year, you know, nobody was talking about romance and football in the same sentence. And all of a sudden, football became romantic. You know, Kansas City is the headquarters for Hallmark, the company, and obviously the Chiefs. It just seemed like a natural fit, especially because love was in the air.
Hanukkah is underway. It started on Christmas night. Your portfolio includes a couple of Hanukkah-themed movies as well.
It does.
How do you think about writing those stories for largely non-Jewish audiences, I'm assuming?
To me, it's an honor because I'm Jewish, and I did marry somebody who is Jewish, and we raised our kid Jewish, but we all as a family really, really enjoy Christmas and Hanukkah. We enjoy Christmas in sort of the secular Santa Claus, you know, way, the Hallmark way, kind of. But that being said, you know, Hanukkah is our primary holiday. And I have never wanted to write a movie that had to explain Hanukkah to anybody, just in the same way that you don't explain Christmas in a Christmas movie. I was very lucky in the first one I wrote was Hanukkah on Rye, that it was just solidly Hanukkah. We didn't have to do, you know, half Christmas, half Hanukkah or anything like that. It was just about this Jewish deli and these two families. For me, it was just easy because I'm just channeling my entire family, the way they talk and the way we are together. And it just has a Jewish vibe. It's just kind of, you know, a little snappier, a little funnier. I've just wanted to show people who may not know anybody who's Jewish or they don't know anyone who does celebrate Hanukkah that, you know, this is a warm, loving, beautiful holiday, just like Christmas is, and it brings families together in a similar way.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Just, you know, as we said, like you've written also a dozen or so Christmas movies, and I'm thinking about the long tradition of Jewish composers and lyricists writing classic Christmas carols, you know, White Christmas by
yes.
Irving Berlin,
yep.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer by Johnny Marks, and many, many others.
Yes.
Do you in any way sort of think of yourself as in keeping with that tradition?
I actually do. It's funny that you said that. I just said that to somebody the other day who asked me, you know, how can you write these, you know, if you're Jewish? And I gave them a list like you just gave me. I think that the lesson there is that we want to contribute to this happiness, to this joy that people feel at the holidays. It doesn't matter, you know, if you happen to be Jewish and write a Christmas movie or vice versa, because if you can put yourself into that world and tell a good story, anybody can write those movies. I'm very happy to do both of them, really. And I do like being part of that legacy.
You know, today many Americans are part of multi-faith families. I am included in that. I have a menorah and a Christmas tree in my living room right now. How do you think about writing holiday-themed scripts in general, you know, for what is really an increasingly diverse country where I think more and more people are sharing a wide variety of traditions?
I mean, I think it's just, it opens up the world for people to have more fun during the holidays because I have a Hanukkah party every year. People love to come and just have that food and that experience. And then conversely, I will go to our friend's house down the street for Christmas Eve and enjoy all of that. And I think, you know, watching these movies and kind of being immersed in that world, it doesn't become a foreign thing to people anymore. It just becomes part of that fabric that we're trying to build.
Well, Julie, I hope you have a happy Hanukkah.
Thank you.
Julie Sherman-Wolf is a screenwriter behind many Hallmark holiday films, including Holiday Touchdown, which is new this year. Julie, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
We light the candles for Hanukkah.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Alex Crow, and that's it. That'll do it for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Really appreciate you making some time for us this morning. And as always, news is on the way here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support for WGTD's local news and public affairs commitment comes from Casey Family Options, a tradition of trust. For more information, including how to get started and pre-planning, visit caseyfamilyoptions.com or call 262-653-0667. Your gateway to public radio is WGTD.